welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley reporting here from Washington, D.C., Washington, D.C., where the Wall Street puppet Barack Obama is in the process of transferring $24 trillion U.S. dollars into the hands of the zombie banks of Wall Street, the various J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, who had a very bad result. They can't even make money under these new hooked-up rules. Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Bank of New York Mellon, Citibank, you know the zombie bank catalog by now, and you've got to learn the executives of those banks, too, so you know who your class enemy is. So we're now told, according to Inspector General Neil Barofsky of the Treasury Department, a kind of overseer of the TARP, that it is now a $24 trillion credit line, $80,000 for every American, all for Wall Street, not for the unions, not for the poor, not for minorities, not for the inner cities, not for the farmers, not for biotech, not for Silicon Valley, none of that. Wall Street, Wall Street, Wall Street, government of the bankers, by the bankers, and for the bankers. So remember, the enemy is Wall Street. The enemy are these financiers, and the necessity, the urgent necessity is if you don't break their power over the Obama regime, this country will be dragged into the abyss. We cannot have a country where the spending priorities are so skewed that California is now sinking into absolute barbarism under the liberal Republican Schwarzenegger with the help of the reactionary Republican faction in the California State Senate and California State Assembly. California is sinking into barbarism. We just heard the ridiculous bill that has gone through the California State Senate, $26 billion in budget gap, and they say cut education, cut higher education, cut your college grants, cut your state parks, cut health, cut welfare, cut your prison budget. Right, let's let a bunch of criminals out. Let's cut police. Let's cut firemen, and so on and so forth. The overriding necessity for California, institute a Tobin tax, institute a securities transfer tax. Wall Street created this crisis. Wall Street should pay for the crisis, not the people, through cuts in education, higher education, health care, welfare, police, fire, and other vital services. They're gouging into the substance of civilization itself. The fiber of human civilization is being rent and torn wantonly in California under liberal Republican leadership, with Arnie leading the charge. Arnie brandishing a dagger. The hand that held the dagger has stabbed it into the back of the people of California. That's Arnie brandishing his dagger, right? He's thinking of Cap the Knife, Weinberger back in the Nixon years. Arnie the knife, Arnie the dagger, Arnie the stiletto. Well, the only shield against that stiletto is the Tobin tax, the securities transfer tax, 1% to be paid by the broker on all transactions of derivatives, over-the-counter derivatives, exchange-traded derivatives. That means options, futures, and everything else in that category, stocks, bonds, real estate, plus that is to say, real estate investment trusts and so forth, and, of course, foreign exchange, commodities, and all the rest of it. So the overriding need for this society is an anti-financier program. Right now, the financial crisis is being dealt with on the backs of the middle class, the workers, and everybody else, really. All other interests are being sacrificed to one paramount interest, which is that of finance capital. And the problem with that is you cannot live by finance capital alone. Finance capital has got to be radically cut down to size, and that is the political task of the next couple of years. Now, we're also now in the middle of the crisis of the Obama regime. As I have pointed out in Obama the Postmodern Coup, the making of a Manchurian candidate, Jimmy Carter, who is the prototype for Obama, the last time we had a 90% to 95% trilateral commission puppet in the White House, run by bankers, right? In those days, it was Volcker. Today, it's also Volcker, plus Summers, plus Geithner, plus the rest of them. The peak of Carter's popularity arrived within the month or so after the 100 days. So that was the first 3 to 4 months, and now we're about at the six-month mark with Obama, and the indications are, of course, that he is beginning to lose traction. Washington Post headline, Monday, July 20th, poll shows Obama slipping on key issues. Healthcare falls below 50%. Healthcare approval for Obama now is approaching 45, maybe 40% after his really catastrophic press conference of this past week. The attempt of the Obama regime is to use multiple strategies of mass brainwashing, scare tactics, lying, dissembling, deception, and so forth, to attempt to stampede the entire Congress into approving a bonanza for bankrupt insurance companies, because that's the issue here. The U.S. insurance industry, the U.S. insurance companies are bankrupt. AIG is what? It's an insurance company. It's bankrupt. They sold $3 trillion of derivatives through their London hedge fund. Similarly, the Hartford, another one of the big Connecticut complex of insurance companies, $3.5 billion from the TARP, and the rest of them, the MetLife, Allstate, State Farm, Prudential, and the rest of them, have all essentially destroyed themselves with derivatives speculation. The ultimate motivation for this Obama policy is, of course, to gouge, to chisel the existing Medicare, Medicaid, and other systems to convoy more and more guaranteed profits into the hands of the private insurance companies, and thereby give them a backdoor bailout from the fact that they're all bankrupt because of derivatives. Here again we see the ruling principle, the method of the Obama regime, the Mussolini fascist corporate state, meaning that the various liberal deluded groups that want health care, of course, it's a legitimate demand, and I'm all for it, and we'll talk about that later. But the idea is to dupe these liberal groups, well-meaning but naive though they are, and get them in a tripartite configuration with the Obama regime, the private insurance companies loaded down with bankrupt derivatives and toxic paper, and then to essentially force the liberal advocacy groups to act as battering rams to get that through against all the resistance that we have. So the good news is that this effort seems to be failing. As of this week, Obama is bogged down. He is not yet in full retreat, but the hysterical push to try to stampede the Congress, to extort bills from the House and the Senate before the congressional August recess would seem to have failed, although groups of fanatics seem to be gathering for some kind of a last stand in the House before they go away under the leadership of Nancy Pelosi. And, of course, Nancy Pelosi's got a Soros agent running her office as Speaker of the House. So when Nancy Pelosi speaks, this is the voice of George Soros, meaning the voice of the New York Federal Reserve and of related interests, because that's who Soros is. So it's not yet the beginning of the end, but it may well be now the end of the beginning. We'll be back in a minute.
Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. I want to call your attention, as always, to my recent books, Obama the Postmodern Coup, The Making of a Manchurian Candidate, the entire story of how Obama got elected by taking those methods that had been used in Tehran 1978, the Philippines 1984, in Kiev, and in Tiflis, Georgia, in the earlier part of this decade, and bringing that all back home. And that was Obama's postmodern coup. We've also got Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography, attracting more attention now that Obama is becoming more and more odious in the eyes of a majority of the U.S. population. Also, Surviving the Cataclysm, the indispensable book, the one indispensable book on economics in the crisis. Here we have a very interesting review posted by someone who I don't know, which I did not solicit, on Amazon.com. This is done by E.L., a reviewer from Chicago, and says, this book was written, actually a lot of it was written, not all of it, was written in 1999, and the author accurately predicts the currently unfolding global economic destruction being wrought by derivatives. He describes in detail the mode by which leverage created through derivative use will and would bring down global banking powerhouses and our nation's economy. His reasoned assumptions of how the Federal Reserve would handle such a crisis is actually chilling to read because he gets it completely right. He gets it completely right. Thank you to E.L. in Chicago. He sums up, he says, a fascinating book for its history of the globaloney financial structures and turmoil that has been caused, along with a prescient analysis of how it comes crashing down. Great book. Thank you to E.L. of Chicago, whom I do not know, but it's good to know that people out there do read and that you get the idea of the book. The only thing I would add is the program. In other words, the big question now is to, of course, understand what has just happened. We've been through a derivatives crisis, not a subprime mortgage crisis. No, no, no. Not a crisis of greed. Not that the American middle class has unreasonable expectations. No, no. But derivatives, derivatives, derivatives. And, of course, the big thing now is the program to get out of such a depression. And we'll be talking about that various points in today's broadcast. But it can't be a reactionary Republican program. It can't be some version of the Austrian school and the Chicago school, because they have helped to cause the crisis. Their deregulation, privatization, union busting, race to the bottom, destruction of the state sector, destruction of the social safety net, and so forth. That is the cause. Now, the London Economist this week has a story about what happened to economics, the failure of economics. We'll be reporting on that next week, but the main point is that they don't get it. They don't understand that this is now, ironically, the triumph of the New Deal system, as we see that all of those New Deal safeguards, the ban on derivatives, Glass-Steagall, the uptick rule, the various kinds of New Deal regulations that had been in place, have all been dismantled because of the Austrians and the Chicago boys. And that is, of course, what has detonated at least this world economic depression. Now, Obama the Postmodern Coup, Obama the Unauthorized Biography, and Surviving the Cataclysm. You can get all those at Amazon.com and indeed at ProgressivePress.com and indeed at other places around the Internet. Use the one that's most congenial to you. Obama's press conference, you notice that he refuses to spell out any details. This, of course, is not increasing confidence. Also, I'm not going to get into the question of his friend, Professor Gates of Harvard, and the various merits of the policeman and Professor Gates, the Harvard professor, simply to say that this shows how amateurish and how bungling Obama is. Stupid, in this context, is Obama. Cruel, as he showed in the cruel as he showed in the part on health care, and stupid as he showed by even allowing this question to come up. The correct answer would be no comment, or I have a conflict of interest, the guy's a friend of mine, I'm not going to comment. Don't comment, because what do? You step on your own story. In other words, the whatever blathering about health care and health insurance Obama wanted to deliver. This has now been eclipsed by the controversy over over Professor Gates. And it simply shows that Obama is a novice, a tyro, a bungler, does not have the political skills. And this is going to be now, we're soon going to get into the kind of stuff we heard from Carter during the Carter administration. Can Obama cope? Is he competent? Can he be president? Is he up to the job? Well, no, of course not. And that was all clear quite a while ago. No experience, no achievements, everything dished up by the fine trilateral hand. A couple of examples. The F-22. Obama has succeeded in defeating the F-22. Well, this is a mixed blessing. If that stays defeated, I think at that point the United States would not have a single assembly line for fighter jets going. Whereas between Russia and China, the estimate is you have 12 assembly lines for fighter jets going. This is not good. Some kind of rough parity, rough balance, approximate balance is always a good idea in strategic and military affairs. It helps stability. If you get too weak, if you're very, very hated and very weak and people think you're rich even though you're not, you may be in trouble, right? Ask the Italian Renaissance in the 1500s. Therefore, we don't want the U.S. to collapse at this rapid rate that we see under Obama. We want the U.S. to maintain some form of rough parity with these other powers simply because it keeps everything on an even keel. If you get too weak, some people may begin to get ideas, and you don't want to find out what those ideas might be. The torpedoing of the F-22 by Obama, and apparently here he worked on it, right? This is very interesting. For card check on the unions, for the cram down that he's now abandoned, Obama didn't lift a finger. For the F-22, it looks like he did some arm twisting and he made some phone calls. Now, Carter did the same thing. Carter's ban of water projects, the various kinds of dams, locks, sewage systems, water systems that Carter destroyed during 1977 is one of the things that poisoned his relations with the Congress. So Obama is now in the process of poisoning his own relations with the Congress, even as relations with the Pentagon have been largely poisoned because of the brusque and insulting way that Obama dismissed General McKiernan, the military traditionalist who had been running the show in Afghanistan, and put in the utopian terrorist controller General McChrystal, who is documented in the New York Times as having been a torturer, somebody who set up 15 torture stations in Iraq, according to the New York Times. So as a result of this, Obama has alienated the Congress. Obama has alienated the firemen with that Sotomayor appointment, right? Whatever we think of Sotomayor, the world's firemen were on the other side. And now in that press conference this past week, Obama has managed to alienate the cops, the Cambridge police, and the doctors, because he accused the doctors of carrying out tonsil operations to get money. So you're building up a lot of groups that you've really alienated and antagonized. Back in a minute.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. So with Carter was attacked by the killer rabbit when he was rowing his canoe. Obama had to swat the fly in the interview with one of these NBC news hounds. So the parallels between Obama and Carter are now building up. They're very, very heavy. This is now the second term of Jimmy Carter under extreme crisis conditions. The other thing, of course, as Obama becomes more and more unpopular, the spell is broken. The birth certificate issue comes out, right? The issue pioneered by Phil Berg. We're going to have Phil Berg on the show in the beginning of our second hour, we hope. But this week we've had Lou Dobbs, radio and TV, CNN, Hannity on Fox News, all talking about the birth certificate issue. MSNBC has gone bonkers one whole day. We had Rick Sanchez, Matthews, and the Olbermann Show all blathering about the birth certificate. And then I think the turning point, this past Wednesday evening, Brian Williams, NBC Nightly News, a whole thing about the birth certificate. This is because some Republican hecklers, and I think these are actually professional hecklers. In other words, I think they're sent in, and I think that's, well, that's fair. All's fair in politics. They've sent in, it reminded me a little bit of that, the riot of the Republican congressional aides to stop the vote count in Florida. Maybe some of the same characters have been hired to go into these meetings. But this is, Congressman Michael Castle of Delaware, liberal Republican, and they heckled him because he's not doing anything about Obama's citizenship. And they're constitutionally, they're on very firm ground, whatever else you may think of their methods and so forth. So, that is now going on. We'll hear from Phil Berg in a minute. The Afghan war. This is now Obama's Vietnam, and we've got to focus on this. This is getting to be a huge crisis. We're going towards these elections in Afghanistan on the 20th of August, so less than a month away. The Obama regime would actually like to dump President Karzai. They would like to turn him into the new DM. They would like to have him found in the trunk of a car. But in the meantime, the body bags, and this is tragic. This is now the worst month in the entire course of the Afghan war, starting in October of 2001. We have 37 U.S. dead so far, 30 NATO dead and rising, and this month is not over. This is now worse than Iraq for the British, and the death count is certain, is on the same scale as Iraq. It is Obama's Vietnam. We had Maliki of Iraq at the White House this week. Not very good relations there, but at least the U.S. might still be on the way out, although that could blow up at any time. That would actually be a strategic catastrophe if it did. If you keep pushing the Iranians with a color revolution, you're going to find that they will retaliate through Iraq. And that will be everybody tied down. 130,000 U.S. still in Iraq now, rising towards 60,000 in Afghanistan. Those ratios are set to flip under Barkey's plan. Joe Biden, motor mouth warmonger Joe Biden, has said that the deaths in Afghanistan are worth it. And, of course, when you say that a hecatomb of deaths are worth it, everybody thinks of Madeleine Albright talking about the Iraqi sanctions. The bankruptcy is now quite apparent. Biden thinks it's worth it, but the British and the Canadians are likely to be the first ones to say, it's not worth it. We're leaving. We've got to get out of here. Remember, the British lost one entire army in Afghanistan in the Afghan War around 1840. One person was allowed to come back to tell this horrendous story. It is the graveyard of empires, more so than Iraq even, although Iraq also has a certain record going back to El Crassus and the Romans. So the crisis of Afghanistan will loom larger and larger. And the very interesting issue is, where is the U.S. peace movement? This week I looked at the Code Pink website. Code Pink, if you look at the Code Pink website, this is Medea Benjamin and her foundation-funded peace fakers. The big issue there is Honduras. They want to bring back this strong-arm character who was ousted in Honduras by the military. In other words, a postmodern coup was defeated by a modern coup for the moment. And Code Pink wants you to get worked up about Honduras, but not about the tidal wave of body bags coming back from Afghanistan. This is the bankruptcy of the foundation-funded peace movement, right? And this shows, you know, essentially what we found in the aftermath of the Kenny Bunkport warning, when a whole bunch of people signed the Kenny Bunkport warning and then claimed that they didn't sign it because their foundation-funding officers said, if you keep your signature on that document, you'll lose your funding. And they all said, oh, no, we can't do that. So this is a sad commentary on the U.S. peace movement. Now, it means that we need new leaders who actually believe in peace, not just bashing Bush. Bashing Bush is fine, but that doesn't mean then that you're going to start supporting the Afghan war and indeed the continuation of the Iraq war that's happening right now. Gordon Brown in Britain is on the verge of collapse. A couple of years ago at this time, right, during the British bank holiday. Bank holiday, of course, is a holiday in Britain. So every August 15th or so, there's a day off called the bank holiday. It doesn't mean there's a bank holiday. It just means it's a holiday in the calendar. Maybe some people are confused. But you remember that in 2007, there was an attempt, 2006 already, to oust Tony Blair with a quick no-confidence vote in the House of Commons when he was away on vacation. Let's see if Gordon Brown takes a vacation, because Gordon Brown is really on his last legs. And he shows Obama his own future in the sense that Gordon Brown was the first guy to come out and say, oh, we've got Northern Rock, we've got Lloyds Bank, we've got Royal Bank of Scotland. We're going to bail them all out. We're going to bail them out to the tune of hundreds of billions of trillions of pounds. Gordon Brown shows you where that policy gets you. It gets you to the point where you're going to collapse. So these issues. Now, if we look at Iran, in the aftermath of the failed people power coup by the U.S. And the British, we see an extremely interesting development. And I'm getting more and more convinced that Ahmadinejad, even though he does not have the intelligence of a Putin, he is a military secret police guy. He does not have the world historical stature of Mustafa Kemal Ataturk, but he might say instead he might not be the new Putin or the new Ataturk. He might be at least the new Mubarak or maybe the new Saddam, if you want. In other words, some kind of a more traditional dictatorship, bureaucratic authoritarian regime, but not controlled by the Anglo-Americans and not run by Obama. So this is now what we see. There's a big controversy in Iran about who is going to be the vice president, and Mousavi has put in his candidate and is insisting on him, even though the supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei, the benighted one, says no, we can't have this guy. And the issue actually is that the candidate that Ahmadinejad wants said some conciliatory things to the Israelis, and therefore the mullah establishment is up in arms because they demand some other kind of complete anti-Israeli rejection front line. So here we have the wife of Mousavi is saying that the country is becoming more militarized, in other words, moving towards a military regime. Mousavi, the wife, says the security forces are expanding their powers. There is a near coup d'etat atmosphere, which is a danger to the Islamic Republic. Now, that would mean a danger to the mullahy, to the existence of these various ayatollahs, grand ayatollahs, and mullahs. Now, we'll get some other comments here, but you get the idea. If you dump the corrupt mullahs and you dump their morality police, you could get some popularity and stabilize your regime. Back in a minute.
GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN, great talk radio starts here.
World Crisis Radio, Webster Tarpley reporting from Washington, D.C., talking about the evolution of Iran towards a possible military dictatorship or traditional bureaucratic authoritarian state, but with Ahmadinejad dumping the mullahs. And it's so interesting. After all the breastfeeding and the brouhaha about how Islamic fundamentalism is so bad, you know, post 9/11, we've had all this stuff, all the neocons, we're now told that Rafsanjani, an ayatollah, a mullah, and the most corrupt man in Iran, and probably somebody who's been bought with some of that $400 million that Bush approved for Iran a couple of years ago, we're told that Rafsanjani is a reformer and that it's a danger if Ahmadinejad kicks out the mullahs, right? Grand Ayatollah Montazeri and his cohorts in Qom, the holy city somehow that's bad now. If you dump the Islamic and just have the Republic of Iran, that's a disaster. And after 30 years of these mullahs badgering everybody, harassing everybody, telling you what to do, everybody would like to dump them. They're corrupt as the day is long, and they somehow busy themselves with kibitzing in everybody else's life. So I think that's where it's going. Watch Ahmadinejad on this choice he has of a vice president, where again, the U.S. is the U.S. coup machine is going to have to be against Ahmadinejad, even though his candidate seems to be open to some kind of negotiated solution with the Israelis. How about that for strange bedfellows? Now, the other interesting quote from Mousavi himself. Remember, we had Mousavi pegged as the candidate of globalization. He wants privatization. He's basically the Austrian candidate over there, I guess we'd have to say. And he wants to help the elite, right? He wants to have the educated pro-Western elite, the rich elitists of North Tehran and the relevant group of desperate housewives. That's the group that Mousavi caters to. So now what does he say? This is now Mousavi talking this past Wednesday. He says the new government being formed by Ahmadinejad could cause domestic and international problems for Iran. And he says the problem is Ahmadinejad is not catering enough to technocrats, managers, and other professionals who don't want to work with him. And the quote from Mousavi is, you have a government, Ahmadinejad, which the elite do not want to work with. The elite. Well, you know, the people voted, and this Ahmadinejad won 2-1. But Mousavi says the elite don't want to work with that government. And on the other hand, the government is not interested in using the experience of the elite. And this will result in a lack of efficiency and legitimacy, which can increase domestic and foreign problems, says Mousavi, speaking to academics and journalists, not to peasant day laborers and agricultural and construction workers or anything like that. In other words, the class basis of the coup is revealed. It is a bunch of elitists, rich, wealthy, pro-Western, educated, internet-oriented elitists in a country where the average person may not have made a telephone call ever in their life. You know, Mousavi's big plank, internet freedom, and the word from the boondocks was, what's the internet? So you get the idea. There's the class basis of this, the elitism, the pro-globalization, he might as well said financial services, because that's really what he's talking about, right? The boys over at Bank Melli and so forth. This is the Obama foreign policy. It's a foreign policy that looks indeed very much like Obama. Now, in addition to Obama, we've also got some of the personalities of the regime running around. We mentioned Biden. Biden thinks that the Afghan war is worth it. But Biden this week has gone to Georgia and Ukraine, he's headed to assure them that the U.S. will support them against Russia and continues to demand their admission to NATO. Think what it means. The fascist madman Saakashvili, who attacked Russia, a crazy step if there ever was one, right? A lunatic attacked Russia almost a year ago, right? Early August of 2008. We're getting up to the first anniversary. And now you're supposed to be signing a treaty with him so that you fight and die for the borders of Georgia and for the Georgian domination of South Ossetia. Are we nuts? The United States, the American people are supposed to commit to the fascist madman Saakashvili? Saakashvili, of course, is doing some window dressing this week. He wants to have democratic reforms after he's been putting people in jail now for the last 3 or 4 months. But the main thing that he wants, Saakashvili wants to be rearmed. He wants to have new anti-tank weapons and all sorts of other weapons paid for by you. When Biden was there, Biden said, hey, Saakashvili, I'm your friend. I gave you $1 billion a year ago. That was when Biden proposed it and Mad Dog Bush the Younger went with it, right? Right after that Georgian attack, the Georgian aggression was rewarded. Of course, with their toy army, they're not going to get anywhere anyway. But This is all absolutely bankrupt. And then he'll go on to Ukraine. He's going to meet the kleptocrats, Yushchenko and Tymoshenko. We just hope that Tymoshenko would go back to her policy of trying to get rid of Yushchenko so that something might come out of Ukraine. But you do get the idea. The other person traveling, in addition to Biden, is Hillary, and this is just dismal. This is just awful. Poor Mrs. Clinton. She's always obsessed by the idea that she's going to be considered weak. She's got to go back to her warmonger posturing. This is the stuff that lost her the election. She could have been president if she hadn't insisted on warmongering in the Democratic primaries, of all places. So she does, of course, try to embrace the soft power doctrine, which is the dominant one of this administration. She went to the ASEAN meeting. Condi Rice had snubbed them 2 years out of the last three. But Hillary has gotten into this mudslinging match with the North Korean press agency. They describe her as a pensioner out on a shopping trip. She says they're infantile. They say she's infantile. She says they're isolated. They say that she's arrogant and deluded, and on and on. So I don't, there may be a reason for that, but I can't see one at the moment. The other thing that she did was she went back to her nuclear deterrence against Iran, right? The idea that if Iran attacks Israel, there'll be a crushing nuclear retaliatory blow. Now remember, compared to the neocon position, that's somewhat better, even though it sounds worse. The neocon position is attack Iran immediately, no matter what they do. That's not going to fly. But so now she says nuclear deterrence, and even so, Netanyahu and Avigdor Lieberman and the rest of these characters have come up saying, how dare you? You're accepting the idea that Iran is going to get nuclear weapons. Well, there it is. The most interesting thing on Hillary's trip, she went to India, and she's billed as an Indiaphile. She loves India. Of course, this is no coincidence. The poor Indians have been singled out as the kamikaze puppet, the expendable asset under the U.S.-India nuclear deal passed about a year ago, so that they'll be used against Russia and China. There are forces in India that don't want to go along, and actually we have one. When she was over there, the other thing that India wants, that the U.S. wants to do to India, of course, is to strangle their economic development, such as it is, to abort the progress of India into the modern age with this absurd global warming myth and the relevant cap and trade carbon tax, carbon emissions limits. And there was a very interesting exchange between Hillary and the environmental minister of India saying, we reject any legally binding limits on carbon emissions for India, and that's the end of it. This, of course, reinforces the failure of Obama in L'Aquila at the Group of Eight, where he was rebuffed by Lula of Brazil and by all the other leading third world states, the other developing countries. So we've got basically China, Brazil, India, and the developing sector in general saying no. No to the rich elitist Malthusians. No to the global warming fanatics. We don't care about your polar bear obsession. We've got to have economic development for our people. So that, I think, is an interesting thing. And it may be his frustration over this that got Mrs. Clinton going in her really degrading exchange, I think, with the people up there in North Korea. So that's what it is. Biden and Hillary, now the face of the U.S., along with Obama. We'll be back in a minute.